Welcome to the Journalism of Everything podcast, a podcast for people who are curious about everything. I'm your host, Doree Smith, an experienced freelance journalist bringing you extensive research, expert interviews, and hopefully many different perspectives from everything on immigration to Ouija boards. Let me start with a story. I grew up in two different kinds of pews. I had my home church, San Jose Baptist Church, which was a somewhat progressive Southern Baptist church in Jacksonville, Florida. And it's where I attended nearly every Sunday and Wednesday from birth until age 17. I sang in the church choir, was part of the Bible Bowl competition, missions groups, and I was very active in my youth group as a teenager. My church wasn't the fire and brimstone that a lot of people associate with Southern Baptist churches, but there certainly was talk of the end times, of Jesus' return, and then whatever was happening in Israel throughout my childhood in the 80s and 90s was frequently mentioned as part of that. The other pew was that of my education. I went to Episcopal schools, first San Jose Episcopal Elementary School, and then Episcopal High School for middle and high school. Episcopal schooling is excellent education, but it does require regular assemblies and church services, and then every Wednesday from age 4 to 17, was a communion service. There was talk of Israel as a reference to the Jews and the Israelites being God's people, but I don't ever remember there being talk of the end times. Of course, the audience of children was probably not the right target for those kind of discussions anyway, but I just don't remember much talk of that, of the apocalypse, of the end of the world. And even not a ton about Jesus' return at the end of the world. Honestly, having these two different kinds of biblical education was a little confusing as a kid because they conflicted each other. One was very literal view of the Bible and the other was not. But I do appreciate that kind of education because I got a very balanced view of Christianity and the Bible, I believe. And I feel like as I've navigated my beliefs, I've been able to do it thoughtfully, but also in an educated manner as I've grown up. And even at age 47, I still grapple with these things. But what I've always wondered is about Israel and the end times. Why is Israel so important to the God of the Bible? Is Israel symbolic of all people now, like we are all God's people? Or are the Jewish people God's chosen ones still? And what does that mean for the rest of us who are not Jewish and do not live in Israel? Should we be paying attention to what is happening in Israel as it is some kind of indicator for the end of the world? For today's episode, I spoke to my longtime friend, Bishop William Gregg. He is a bishop in the Episcopal Church, has a PhD in theology from the University of Notre Dame. He has a Master's of Divinity from the Episcopal Divinity School. And it's just a very intelligent, very thoughtful person, and I have known him for at least 15 years. Before I delve into the interview, though, I want to start with a brief and honestly very oversimplified view of modern Israel, how it came to be, and then just all of the conflict that surrounds it and where we are today. So I want to go through a rapid fire timeline of what has happened in Israel and between Israel and Palestine since the early 1900s. And this is going to be like rapid fire as much as I can, complete oversimplification. But just to give you an idea of all that has happened and sort of the history of the conflict, at least in modern times. I got most of this information from, at least this timeline from the BBC. They have a kind of a, it's a more, obviously I condensed it, but a timeline of what has happened since 1917. All right. The roots of the Israel-Palestinian conflict stretch back to 1917, and that is when Britain issued the Balfour Declaration, which basically supported a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. Palestine had been occupied by the Ottoman Empire. Now, with the Balfour Declaration, there was the promise that the rights of non-Jewish communities would not be harmed. After World War I, the San Remo Conference gave Britain a mandate after over Palestine, and also from there, because of that, lots of Jewish people who were not living in Palestine immigrated, especially from Europe. So fast forward to World War II, and after all the horrible things that happened during the Holocaust, there was a lot of global support for the Jewish people to have their own state. In 1947, the United Nations proposed what they call a partition plan, which was for separate Jewish and Arab states. And then they wanted to put Jerusalem under international control. So neither Israel nor Palestine were to have Jerusalem. In 1948, Israel declared independence. And this sparked the first of a few Arab-Israeli war, which actually displaced around 750,000 Palestinians. And this happens a lot. Palestinians have been displaced a lot over this over all the years of conflict. In 1967, after a lot of tension and just rising conflict, Israel launched a preemptive strike and won the Six-Day War. And then they took control of East Jerusalem, the West Bank, Gaza, and other parts. And then from there, Israeli settlements started to take over Palestine. So more displacements of Palestinians. And then in 1973 was the Yom Kippur War, where Egypt and Syria, largely Arab nations, attacked Israel, but Israel ultimately prevailed. In 1978, with the help of President Jimmy Carter, we had the Camp David Accords trying to have some peace in the area. And with the Camp David Accords, the Sinai was returned to Egypt, but there just can still continue to be conflict. I mean, this is the way it is. There's peace is attempted and then conflict, and then peace is attempted and then conflict. In 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon so they could get rid of the PLO. The first Intifada happened in 1987. And out of that, in particular, the first Intifada, 1987 is where Hamas came out to, Hamas is considered a terrorist organization by many, but it's out to basically return Palestine to the Palestinians. Again, very simple definition of that. In 1993 were the Oslo Accords, which did create a path for Palestinian self-rule. Israel did withdraw from parts of Gaza and the West Bank in 1994, but there was new leadership in Israel. So more tensions rose after that. Then they had a very violent second intifada and just more conflict, more mistrust between the Israelis and the Palestinians. By the 2000s, it was very violent in this area, in this part of the Middle East. Lots of suicide bombings, lots of military operations, and then the Israelis continued to expand their settlements into parts that were historically Palestinian, or at least, you know, for a long time were in Palestinian hands. In 2005, Israel pulled out of Gaza, but Hamas won the elections in 2006. This was a big, big thing. And when Hamas won the elections, they started launching rocket attacks and triggering repeated Israeli military responses. So they attack, Israel responds, back and forth. And there were major, major clashes in 2008, 2014, and 2021. Now, in 2017 was when President Trump was in office. He did something no other U.S. president has ever done, and he recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Remember, it's never been considered Israel's capital. And in 2019, the U.S. also said that West Bank settlements, as in Israeli settlements, were not illegal. And this was a very big deal. And this was, the U.S. was very largely criticized by the international community for saying that. And in October 2023, Hamas launched a surprise attack on Israel, killing over 1,200 people and taking more than 250 hostages. The result was the Gaza war, and it's been horrible. If you watch the news, lots of destruction, especially in Gaza, but all over. And now that it's July 2025, the conflict has widened. The U.S. has increased its influence and has been helping Israel more. And the Israel and U.S. have launched military strikes on Iran in targeting its nuclear program. And basically, the region has been more unstable now than it has been in decades. So Israel and Palestine are important on a political and a religious world stage. The location in the Middle East is vital to at least three major world religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. Depending on which religious document you read, whether it's the Bible, the Torah, or the Quran, this part of the world is very important to each document. There are many prophecies in the Christian Bible, especially about Israel and how it indicates the end of the world. And the more evangelical conservative Christian pastors often speculate about when Jesus will return according to the relative peace or war that's going on in Israel. So let's hear from Bishop William Gregg about what that is all about. This is part one of the interview, and then the next episode will have the second half of it. I hope you enjoy. So today I am interviewing Bishop William Gregg, who currently is, in air quotes, retired, but is also rector at St. Thomas Episcopal Church in Reidsville, North Carolina, and is an adjunct professor of systematic theology at Hood Theological Seminary, which is in Salisbury. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Bishop Gregg has a BA from the University of Richmond, master's in divinity from Episcopal Divinity School, MA in medieval English from Boston College, which I did not know, an MA and a PhD from the University of Notre Dame. Now, having said all of that, in our family, we call him Bill and we call him Opa. We have known Bill and his lovely and wonderful wife, Kathy, since what, 2008? Something like that.
Yeah,
I
something.
think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
At
we,
least 15 years ago.
at least, right? Gosh. And we Zoom with them every Sunday from 5 to 6 Pacific. And they are our son's third set of grandparents. In fact, Kathy was there the day he was born, and you were there, not, I think, just a couple of days after. So
Right.
I am lucky to know you in all of these ways, but I would say you definitely know the Bible and this topic. Is there anything you'd like to change in your introduction?
We hope so. Now that sounds good. Other than just to note that the MA in medieval English was lots of fun, completely useless, and I wouldn't give it up for anything.
That's how I feel about my English major. Lots of fun. I loved British literature, and I don't know. I think English majors have a lot of skills, so it's good stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So today we're going to just talk about, so there's a lot going on in Israel in the Middle East right now. There always is, but in particular, there's a lot going on in the last few years. So kind of let's just start with, I guess, a basic idea. Why is Israel so important in the Bible? And then is it, you know, when the Bible references Israel, is it referencing a specific state, a kind of people, or is it maybe symbolic of something else?
Yes.
All of it.
I think that's a good question. Israel, as we think about Israel popularly today, is a place, is a geographical reality that certainly has to do with the identity of the Jewish people, both as the people of God and as their home place. This is the promised land that was given to them by God following the exodus from Egypt and the 40-year wandering in the Sinai Desert area. And so it's a geographical reality. Two, it is therefore also part of the identity of Judaism and the Jewish people as their home, their place in the world. And thirdly, I think it does have a symbolic value in the Judeo-Christian tradition that's attached not only to God's selection of this particular people as the people of God, but it's also symbolic of a whole history and relationship between God and the Hebrew, now Jewish people, and Christian people who emerged out of the Jewish tradition.
Interesting. So the boundaries of Israel as they are right now, are those the general boundaries that are outlined in the Bible? Or I know that might be, I don't know how clear it is.
Sort of. It's hard to tell. If you look in a Bible at a Bible map, they identify Judea and Israel and Bethlehem and all those kinds of things. Basically, it's always more or less the shape of what we know currently as Israel. I can say with relative certainty that, yeah, that's more or less that's the area. I suspect that to a certain extent, the current configuration of the state of Israel geographically, and the influence of biblical descriptions were certainly a part of that. It was almost created out of nothing in a sense. The state of Israel did not exist until 1947 and hadn't existed for quite some time historically. And so whether the map was drawn using maps that people had studied from their Bible or in theology, biblical studies, all of those things, I really don't know. But in general, yes, that's the geographical area.
Okay, that's good to know. Yeah, because I've looked at into it, and there's so many things going on because you have references to the Bible, obviously, where this is coming out, but you also have the political layers of it as well. So sometimes those borders change according to political objectives, for sure. Yeah. You know what? Okay, I think she's rustling, but I think we'll be okay.
Gaza, for example, is a carve out.
What's up? Got right.
Gaza is a carve out
Right.
where the Palestinians were to go, and that was to be the Palestinian part of Israel.
Right.
The West Bank is a kind of carve-out
Right. Okay.
thing,
So
as you distinguish between the Palestinian population and the Israeli population.
right. Okay. Gotcha. So, why are the Israelites considered God's chosen people? And I mean that in a, obviously, there's the biblical references, but there are lots of, people in this world that we're now aware of, that maybe weren't aware of when the Bible was written and influenced. So, why are they considered God's chosen people? And then what does that mean to the rest of us?
Right. Yeah, that's a question that goes back to the first decades of Christianity, at least. The question came up in the early church, the apostolic period, of, well, what about the Jews? If we believe in Christ and the Jews have rejected Christ, are we now the chosen people that have superseded the Jewish people? And St. Paul's answer was no.
Uh-oh.
And moreover, Paul was pretty emphatic about, and besides that, it's none of your business. Don't worry about that, because that was God's decision, God's call to this group of people. And as far as Paul was concerned, and knew, God had not revealed any change of designation. So I think within that context, we can think about the Jewish people as God's chosen, primary chosen people through whom God worked to reveal God's self in the world and to work God's plan of redemption that is realized from a Christian perspective in the birth, life, death, and resurrection and ascension of Jesus.
Okay.
And remember, it's also important to remember that Jesus was a Jew. Jesus was not Christian.
Right.
Paul essentially was always a Jew of the Pharisaic tradition who believed that Jesus was the Messiah.
Interesting.
And so I would be very careful about, I think we have to be a little nuanced about those kinds of things, because otherwise it gets really mushy. So in that context, How we understand what it means to say that the Jewish people are God's chosen people is to talk about God's revelation to this people and the calling of them to be the people through whom God worked and continues to work
Sure.
to do God's work in the world that, from a Christian perspective, moves toward redemption and is involved with a whole theology of the kingdom and those sorts of things. The Christian relationship to that is that I would argue we are, in another sense, also God's chosen people, in the sense that God works through Christian people in the same way that God worked through the Jewish people and continues to do so through both groups. But I think the current world situation is that we need to understand that all of those relationships between God and the Jewish people, between God and Christians, between God and Muslims, between God and Hindu or spiritualist or animist or whatever one might be, is a very particular relationship. And so to claim the designation God's chosen people really has to be nuanced into particularity of the various relationships God has, and not understood as exclusionary. Or I would argue that it really can't be exclusionary if we take seriously what God revealed of God's self in Jesus. For example, God so loved the world. It doesn't say God so loved a part of the world or this particular people. It's just the world. John was very careful about how he articulated things like that. And as you were pointing out earlier, we now know much more about the world and much more about how many more people are there. And I don't see, as a Christian looking at this, or an Episcopalian, that those people who are not Jewish or Christian are not beloved of God, are not part of God's people. Though each
Interesting.
one may have a different kind of relationship, within the integrity of each of those religions and each of those traditions.
Interesting. Yeah, it's tricky because I think there's so much, obviously, in the Bible they talk about Israel and the Israelites and them being God's chosen people, certainly. But you know, there's been a lot of time that have happened and a lot of, you know, awareness that has happened since then. So yeah, that makes sense. God so loved the world. Yeah. Let me, yeah, go ahead.
I think it's really important to distinguish also between the state of Israel, which is a governmental unit, a nation state, which functions as a nation state in certain kinds of ways and does certain kinds of acts as a nation state. I think it's interesting to point out that when Israeli government officials address the world about how Israel is functioning, what they're doing, particularly in the last 12 days or back from October, that the language is the language of we have a right to self-defense. We have a right to maintain the integrity of our nation state. They do not make an explicitly biblical argument about this is the promised land, this is the land that God gave us, we are entitled to it because in our tradition and experience, this was a gift of God given particularly and exclusively to us.
Hmm.
Now, where that understanding lies within the governmental personalities and agencies, I don't see it publicly. Where it lies in the population of Israel, the Israeli people as Israeli people, I think is a different kind of question. And it's probably much more explicit. I think if you probably talked to the more conservative wing of Judaism, that would certainly be part of their argument. The Orthodox Jewish person would, of course, understand from a biblical perspective, which is the heart of their understanding of themselves, their country, and the world. The covenant relationship with God, the gift of this land to them, is a defining kind of peace. But I think we need even further than that, we need to distinguish between Israel as a nation state, the Israeli government of that nation state, and Judaism as such, and practicing Jewish people who are of the Jewish religion. And I think where it gets particularly dicey is the kind of cavalier way, in many senses, that the term anti-Semitism is thrown around. And I think that criticizing the nation state of Israel is different from being anti-Semitic or being condemnatory and judgmental about Judaism and the practice of Judaism and that faith, which is certainly inappropriate. It also, and I think the other dynamic there is that it's the same kind of paintbrush we see in the United States, particularly with regard to racism between white and black people, the paintbrush with which a white supremacist paints black people, the abstract, all black people are kind of thing, or the way we treat Hispanics and anybody who is different, LGBTQ plus. That becomes a kind of ad hominem attack against a people. And that is to be condemned. That is not to be tolerated. I think it's necessary in the political world today that we have to take a critical view about nation states, whether it's Israel or the United States or NATO or Russia or whatever. Critical.
That's an interesting distinction to make because I think just as a citizen, a person, a journalist, I am hesitant to criticize the state of Israel, for what is going on because I wouldn't want to be considered anti-Semitic, because I'm not. So that's an interesting distinction to make. All right. I think, I don't know. All right. So let's kind of segue into prophecy and prophecy about Israel. Just kind of start from the beginning. What do you think of the Bible as a prophetic document? As in, I mean, some in the clergy really put a lot of credence in the prophecies of the Bible, and others don't. So where do you stand kind of on the Bible as prophetic?
Prophetic. Well, I think the general answer to that is that the Bible is prophetic. It was intended to be prophetic. The catch is you have to understand what prophetic means. What is prophecy? And again, there's sort of the popular informal opinion that tends to look at prophecy as a kind of soothsaying or telling what the future is going to be, prediction. Biblically speaking and theologically speaking, prophecy means to speak God's word. And so the prophets were not sent into Israel to Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel, were not sent to be fortune tellers to tell Israel what was coming. They were to speak God's word. What did God want to know? Want the people of Israel to know? And so, in that sense, the prophetic word is a revelatory word. In another sense, the prophetic word is also a word of invitation. It's a word of God calling, frequently calling the people back to the covenant relationship with God, that restores right relationship. So the prophecies, they do speak to things that are going to happen, but the context of what's going to happen is always within the covenant relationship between God and God's people, which is it's a contractual kind of thing where I, your God, will do this, this, and this, and you, as the people, will do this, this, and this. You will keep my commandments, you will observe my laws and audience ordinances, you will make your sacrifices, you will worship. The Ten Commandments sort of are a well-known, here's what you're to do. Here's how you're to live in right relationship with me and each other. So when the prophets like Ezekiel is talking about what God's going to do to Gog and Magog, for example, that great apocalyptic vision, I don't think to the biblical authors the details of facticity that modern people tend to think with are as important as the affirmation that God is not going to leave the relationship and project with God's chosen people unfinished. God is not going to abandon God's people. And from a Christian perspective, that all comes to its ultimate fulfillment in the incarnation and the life, death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus. So I think when we talk about prophecy, we're talking about something that first is in the context of a relationship between God and God's people. Secondly, in the Old Testament, we're talking about it in terms of a relationship that is articulated in covenantal language. And the particular form of Old Testament covenant was the suzerain treaty, which is a covenant between the party of the first part, who's the more powerful, i.e., God, and the party of the second part, who is the lesser power, i.e., the people of God. And it's an agreement that this is how we're going to relate to each other.
Interesting.
So, for example, Noah and the Ark, the Noah covenant was the rainbow, and God's covenanting, promising, I'm not going to ever do this again. The covenant relationship, the problem that Jeremiah and Isaiah, for example, were addressing was a problem of breaching of covenant. Prior to the Babylonian exile, the breaching of covenant by worshiping other gods, which breaks the first commandment of the Ten. So that the prophet's job was to call the people back to who they were supposed to be in that covenant context.
Oh,
And
interesting.
to say, if you don't, if you break the covenant, these are the consequences of your decisions. You will be held accountable by God. You will be judged by God. There will be consequences or judgment that comes from God. The biggest one being the Babylonian exile, which is also the context of Ezekiel.
Right.
When God used states around Israel to defeat Israel and Babylon to take almost everybody to Babylon for a long period of time.
Right. Is
So
that the 40 years
at
or
least 40 years. Some
okay?
argue longer, but at
Okay.
least 40 years. And that would be consistent with the biblical use of 40, 40 years in the desert,
Right.
those kinds of things. And I think that that pattern of prophecy, breach of relationship, or breach of relationship, prophecy, judgment, consequences, always ends in restoration and a new covenant. So that what God reveals about God's self is God's steadfastness in relationship to the chosen people. God has committed to the people of Israel to be their God and for them to be the people through whom God particularly reveals God's self into the world.
So, where does that leave us? In a conflict rooted in biblical promise, colonial strategy, and geopolitical firestorms, Israel has become more than just a place. It's a symbol of faith, prophecy, displacement, and defiance. And yet, as Bishop Gregg reminded us, it's critical to separate the ancient idea of a people chosen by God from the modern machinery of a state acting in war. Is criticism of a government the same as attacking a faith? Is prophecy about future destruction, or is it about divine relationship? And when we say God so loved the world, does that still allow room for exclusivity? And the conflict continues, and so do the casualties, and so does the theology. And maybe that's the most dangerous part. When sacred texts are used to sanctify modern war, who gets to speak for God? I am going to be moving my social media operations over to YouTube and focusing a lot of my effort there. You will always find the podcast on all of the podcast apps like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, Pandora, iHeartRadio, like all of them. But social media-wise, instead of spreading myself too thin on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, Blue Sky and YouTube, I'm just going to put my focus onto YouTube. I'll post occasionally on Instagram and Facebook, but I'm always going to direct you to my YouTube channel. So please join me there and please give me a follow. Thanks for listening to the Journalism of Everything podcast. This is Doree Smith. Join me next episode for the next half of Bishop Gregg's interview, where we'll talk more about what the end times means and if it matters now in 2025.